From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for listening to our weekly wrap-up of Connections. It was a heavy week in the news, with conversations about immigration and the separation of families at the border dominating the news cycle. We were joined on the talk show by two immigrants who shared their stories. Gabriela Quintanilla is the Western New York Associate Coordinator for Rural and Migrant Ministry. She was only 13 when she and her sisters left El Salvador. Their month-long journey was nearly tragic. Gabriela almost lost her four-year-old sister in the middle of the night when they were crossing the Rio Grande. She found her on the other side of a barbed wire fence. Gabriela says she will never forget how it felt to be separated. On Connections, she discussed what she thinks Americans' biggest misconceptions are about immigrants. You'll hear her, and then you'll hear Cesar Vargas, co-director of the Dream Action Coalition, and New York's first undocumented attorney admitted to the New York bar. Here's Gabriela.
I think above all, I would like people to know that immigrants love their country. Immigrants love the place that they're leaving behind, and it's a devastating process to leave your land and everything that you're familiar with, to leave your freedom, to come to a country for the betterment of your family. I know personally for my mother, she's always been a single mother for me and my sisters, and she made the decision to immigrate to this country to give me and my sisters a better life so that we would have a better education so that we would turn into decent professionals and that we would give back to our community, but most importantly, never forget where we come from. And how amazing is that, that at her forefront, she just wanted her children to have a better life and for us to be better people and to support whatever community we were in. There was never once said, you know, you're coming here, Gabriela, to study and I want you to get a degree and go back to, you know, El Salvador, but rather whatever you go, do good. And so the other misconception I think that people have is that immigrants are coming here to steal jobs. We're not coming here to steal jobs. We're coming here to do the jobs that nobody else wants to do. And another thing is, you know, immigrants can benefit from the system. Undocumented people don't qualify for welfare. And all of these misconceptions that are not true. And we are here to make this country a better place. We love this land as much as, or I love this land as much as I do my home country. I consider this my home, and I consider El Salvador my home. It's the place where I live, where my family is.
I'm going to ask the entire panel. I'm going to turn to Cesar Vargas first, next up here, because his time is short and he's got to go in just a minute. Cesar, what do you think we get wrong about this process, about the people who are coming here?
Well, you know, I think this is, you know, going back to the same question about this is where we need to have an honest debate of where we are in this country. And yes, there is some channels for some people to regularize their immigration status, but reality is that we still have 11 million undocumented immigrants who don't have that channel, who are living here for more than 10, 15, 20, 30 years, who have U.S. citizen children, spouses, who have, you know, whose children are in the military, whose spouses are in the military, you know. And I think this is where we need to really have an honest discussion of where we are and where we're heading. We're not helping ourselves in the global arena when we are seen as a nation that's ripping apart children. And I think for us as an attorney, we need to have those updated laws that we can truly represent and reflect the values of what this nation is about. You know, we don't have, it's like still having a black and white television. It's like still having a beeper, you know, and working on this as, you know, as a professional. So, you know, we are functioning under outdated laws. We're functioning under laws that not only need to be changed, but need to also be compel us to exercise discretion. You know, immigration has a lot of authority. The Department of Justice has an extensive authority to keep a parent in the U.S. without, despite what the law says. You know, and I think this is where we have within the legal system the ability to forego enforcing laws because we deem them unnecessary or unworkable. There's no reason why, you know, a state trooper or a police officer can't let go someone who's going, you know, speeding for like 2 miles versus that person should focus on the speedster who's, you know, speeding across a highway going 90, 120 miles per hour. You know, so we need to focus our resources on people who threaten us violent harm and not on people who are crossing, escaping, and pursuing a better life. or a parent who's working hard. So this is where we need to really reflect on this, and this is where we have a debate on immigration for all of us to have, right? Whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, we also need to have that giant conversation as Americans.
Next, the recent suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain have sparked concern among mental health advocates, who note that celebrity suicides have a copycat impact on the general population. Our guests discuss suicide from a range of angles. In this clip, you'll hear Bill Perrin, a suicide attempt survivor.
Well, in the place I was at, I was in so much pain, and my brain had come into such a place that I could not envision a future where anything would get better or where this pain would cease. And the pain was tremendous, both mental and physical. And so then it appears that there are no options except to end my life, which is where I was at that point.
What did you express to those around you?
Well, I was in the middle of being hospitalized multiple times. I had been, I relocated here to Rochester, where I grew up, from Virginia, where I was living, so that my parents and my sister could care for me because I was pretty much unfunctional. I'm sorry, go back. What was your question?
Well, it sounds to me like you at least had loved ones around you who understood that you were in crisis.
Yes, I had great support, and I actually vocalized my suicidal ideation, my thoughts, and that was pretty much why I was in the hospital, in and out, in and out. When I finally started to get better even a little bit, then my loved ones around me started to relax a little, and it was one of those days when they were gone from the house that I had attempted suicide via overdose, and I had sort of hidden it. I sort of stopped talking about the ideation. And
did you do that on purpose?
I think I was just tired of it all. I was so tired and in so much pain that I didn't want to keep going around in circles.
If you had died that day, do you think your family members, do you worry that they would have been left with the guilt or any sense of blame?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Have they talked about that?
No. That has not come up. But I'm sure it has between them, between my parents and my son Ethan's only 12, so I'm not sure where he is in the process.
I think about the people who have written stories, even just about Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, to say nothing of the thousands of people who die by suicide in this country every year. Even in those high-profile cases, you have people who were friends of these larger-than-life figures saying, I didn't know. How did I miss a sign? I wish I would have known. And you can see, even in their public statements, a feeling of pain or regret. What would you express to anybody in a moment of wonder? Did I miss a sign? Did I not do enough? A feeling of blame.
I would say the feeling of blame is misplaced or unwarranted, that there's no magical sign, one sign, or a list of signs. Well, I mean, there are some that you can look at, but in terms of wondering whether I missed something or not, that's almost impossible to quantify, having missed something, because as someone with a mental illness myself, I can be acting one day, the next, and it's hard to tell whether there are signs.
You were someone who expressed these ideations. You had family members who understood, and yet you still ended up in a position one day where you decided that you were going to make the attempt to die. So you had intervention.
Correct.
Around you. Do you look back now and you know, would there have been a different kind of intervention that would have been more effective to stop you from even making the attempt, Bill?
Not that I can think of. I mean, I can't emphasize enough. It's the place I was in was, I liken it to the analogy being on a burning raft out at sea with sharks circling. And that's what my life felt like. And every morning when I woke up, I said, damn, I'm still here. And my life was still like that. And I was still in so much pain. And so when that goes on and continues, even in the midst of support and help, at a certain point, I just could not bear it any longer.
And so now I want you to send a message, if you could, to the people who may feel that way now. And here you are 10 years later. You felt like you were in the middle of an ocean in a burning raft surrounded by sharks. There was no way out. But here you are today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, I'm pleased to say. And my message to people would be that there's always a choice, that it's really the illusion that the illness brings to us that there is no choice, which can be hard to see through. I worked with my therapist for quite a while, and she kept inviting me to entertain the thought that things could change for the better, and I literally could not entertain those thoughts, but it's possible. And now today, after a lot of hard work, I did not go back to work. I used to be an attorney, but my life's pretty much comprised of volunteering with NAMI and some other folks, my life with my 12-year-old son, Ethan, who I love dearly, and been trying to write a book for about 5 or 6 years, not autobiographical, but.
Okay, so you have a lot going on.
Yeah.
Are you, I mean, I forgive sort of the triteness of this question. Do you consider yourself happy?
I consider myself very happy.
We'll close the week with a question. What should we do when artists misbehave? In other words, when an author, actor, director, or artist does something offensive or acts inappropriately or steps over the line in some way, should we stop consuming their art? When do we give them a pass? Should we? The founder of Writers and Books, Joe Flaherty, dealt with this question when he was arranging for Philip Roth to visit Rochester. The late writer was considered a misogynist by many readers. In this clip, Joe Flaherty tells the story of inviting Roth to Rochester, and then he discusses if you have to separate the writer from his characters. You'll also hear Patty Lewis, a local actor, director, and teaching artist. But first, here's Joe.
I called up Philip Roth's number, and a woman answered, and she had a British accent, and I was thinking, wow, this is really classy. You know, he's got a British secretary, you know, answering his calls. And she said, well, who may I ask is calling, and why are you calling? And I told her, you know, I'm Joe Flaherty from Writers and Books in Rochester, and I'd love to see if it's possible for Philip to come up and, you know, read from his work. And she said, well, he's not here right now. When he writes, he goes to our house in Connecticut. And then she said, our house in Connecticut. And I was like, oh, this is not a secretary, you know.
It's his wife.
It's his wife. And she said, so let me, you know, take your name and number and I'll give the information to him. But I don't know why you would like to invite him. He's a very despicable human being. And I was like, ooh, you know, what have I gotten myself into here?
She wasn't kidding.
No, she wasn't kidding. You know, and she said it in a very, you know, calm British, you know, reserve,
yeah.
You know. I don't know why you would want to invite him. He's a completely despicable human being. And I said, oh, you know, so she said, I will give him the message. And I thought, I'm never going to hear from Philip Roth. You know, I mean, I don't know what I got into here. So the next day, there's a telephone call, and it's from Philip Roth. And he says, hello, you know, may I speak to Joe Flaherty? I said, this is he. He said, well, this is Philip Roth. I said, oh, thank you for returning my call. He said, I understand you spoke to my wife. And I said, yes. She said, and what did she say about me? And I said, well, you know, running through in my mind, you know, I said, well, she said that when you're writing, you go to the house in Connecticut, and that's why you weren't there. And he goes, yes. And what else did she say about me? And I said, that was really about it, you know?
So left out the whole despicable part.
Yeah, right. I was not going to get into that. And so we arranged for him to come up. I mean, he was going to come to Rochester for a reading. And the day of his reading, he was fogged in at LaGuardia and just could never get out. And we said, talked to him. He called several times. There was no cell phones at that point. And he said, well, we'll talk in a few days and rearrange. And, you know, it never really
never
happened.
Came to be.
Never came to be. And I found out later that it was at a time just before they split up, and it was really a kind of a horrible situation. And both of them wrote tell-all books within the next year.
About each other.
About each other, yes. But the interesting thing, getting back to this topic, was that after I announced that he was coming, I got lots of phone calls saying, I don't understand why you would invite Philip Roth to come up. He treats Jewish women and Jewish mothers horribly. Why would you invite him? And I would say, well, you have to separate the writer from his characters. And I mean, that was just sort of my answer to them. So, you know, if you do not like somebody's writing, that doesn't mean that, you know, that's particularly his point of view on everything. You know, otherwise, how would you have writers be able to create villains? I mean, if there's going to be a villain and there's going to be a hero, I mean, somebody has to write that villain. And if you think, well, that's that author created that villain and that villain is a horrible person, I don't want to, you know, hear or meet that person. So that was really sort of, I mean, there was a number of times throughout my career I had to do that sort of, say, separate the author from their characters.
So let me ask all of the panel then, and I'm going to push Joe a little bit on this, and we'll get everybody's take, because this is one of the central questions here, is do you separate the art from the artist, or is it sort of tied inextricably? You know, Joe, if I'm an author, you know, I'm writing fiction, and I am writing plots that contain violence against women, that kind of maybe carry all of the stereotypically awful things, if I'm writing racist characters, if I'm just using my fiction as a vehicle for really bad or ugly ideas, don't I bear some responsibility for that? Isn't there some?
Well, I think it again goes back to context. If the author is creating that character so that you can, as a reader, get into the mind of somebody who's okay, a serial killer,
sure,
or a racist, to better understand, you know, what kind of thinking, what kind of person thinks that, I don't think they're glorifying that. They're just saying, okay, here's a character that I've created.
Sure.
And, you know, there are serial killers out in the world, and I've created one so that you might read this and have a better understanding in an immediate way of what that kind of person is.
Okay.
Like.
Now, that's fair enough. And now let me ask the question a different way. Do you separate the art from the artist in that in their personal lives, they do things that are either criminal, horrible, abusive, but their art, separate, it's a comedian, it's a writer, it's an actor, it's anybody. It's not related to that personal life. Do we separate it? Patty, do we separate those things?
I think that once you have that knowledge, it is bound to color your perception. And I think there's also a gradation. I mean, if someone is clearly a criminal, let's say Harvey Weinstein, still alleged, but, you know, let's say that those things
are... Yeah, well, tell his lawyers to come
okay,
after us. He's a criminal.
Okay, so...
Allegedly.
You know, that to me is an extreme, okay? There are some places that I can't walk back from. As I mentioned before, you know, Woody Allen, you know, Roseanne, Bill Cosby, I agree. I mean,
But you just mentioned three, all of whom are unrepentant. Turn themselves into victims. And that's very different.
It is different.
Than I'm trying to imagine, I mean, Louis C.K.'s apology. I mean, I'm trying to think of there's probably a long list who've acknowledged some degree mm-hmm. of wrongdoing
yes.
or contrition. You just mentioned three who have done the opposite. And I understand sort of the animus you would feel to someone who not only abuses, but refuses to be accountable.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. I think that if people aren't capable of change and capable of growth, then that's a pretty sorry thing. And it may take decades. It may take years.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the meantime, the work that was made during that period is always going to be colored by that, I think.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks as always for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.